Businesses, government agencies, universities, and major cultural institutions acknowledge that more needs to be done to help women gain footing in the workplace equal to that of men. But despite years of well-meaning diversity workshops and training programs, there has been little success in reversing gender discrimination. In her new book, What Works? Gender Equality by Design, Harvard University behavioral economist Iris Bennett argues that our failure to level the playing field is due to the unconscious biases that we all carry around with us. Rather than try to de-bias people, which she argues is an impossible task, no matter how much we all want to be free of our biases, it's far better to design our institutions in a way that removes the bias from the way things are done. Iris Bennett is the author of the new book, What Works? Gender Equality by Design. We spoke with her about this subject and about how you can design gender equality.
First, any organization which wants to fix anything should measure what is broken. And so clearly, data collection is a first important insight. And then once we have understood what is broken, we can apply some of these design principles to improve how we hire, how we promote, and even how we decorate our walls.
So how do we know that one will affect the other in the sense of what will work in that, that what we put on our walls will eventually lead to the disintegration of this particular bias?
That's an excellent question, and in fact, it motivated the title of my book, which is called What Works, because what I'm trying to argue in the book is that we should base our decisions on evidence that ideally is collected in experiments. And when I say experiments, I quite literally mean experiments, the kinds of trials that are normally run in the natural sciences where we have a treatment group which gets the new portraits on the wall or does use a new interview protocol, and the control group, which doesn't get the treatment, doesn't get the intervention, and then really trying to measure what difference does difference make, and do these groups then afterwards behave differently.
That idea of behaving differently, is that an immediate reaction or is that a gradual reaction?
It depends a bit on the intervention. Let me give you an example that orchestras introduced in the 70s. So many of the major orchestras in the United States came up with quite an ingenious design innovation in the 70s when they realized that they only had about 5% female musicians. Namely, they introduced screens or curtains and had musicians audition behind the screens. And what they found was that the screen increased the likelihood that women would advance to future rounds by 50%. And played an important part in increasing the fraction of female musicians on our major orchestras to almost 40% today. That's a huge increase from 5 to 40%. It didn't happen overnight, to your question, but the screens themselves played a very, very important role. I think we can learn two things from the screens. One, that bias really is quite powerful. This is not about pointing fingers at bad people. This is about all of us, including well-meaning orchestra directors who were intending to listen to the music and not whether somebody looks the part, but couldn't help it. And secondly, that simple design, a change in how we do things rather than trying to change mindsets, can have very powerful impacts.
And that type of scenario is instructional because you may have in your mind that it is a male playing that music, and then when the screen is removed, you realize that it is a female. But there are ways that you describe as well where it's more front and center. You know that the work is being done by a female, but there are ways of changing the mindset there as well.
Yeah, no, that's true. But first, what you just said is right, that seeing is believing, and our biases often are influenced by whether we see male kindergarten teachers or not. But some of our work has looked at an alternative to screens. So blind evaluations are very attractive, and I encourage many organizations to explore this option for early rounds. But at some point, probably most people will want to see the job candidates and are unable to blind themselves to the demographic characteristics of these people. So what we've been showing is that anything that we evaluate, whether it is the coffee that you drink or the food that you eat or the job candidates in front of you, anything that we evaluate is relative. We need to compare the things that we see to make sense of the world. And that's a kind of a basic insight into how our minds work. And what happens when I see a job candidate is that I intuitively compare him or her with a comparator, and the comparator likely is the reference point or the stereotype, the typical person I'm used to in that particular role. And in order to debunk that stereotype, so short of blindness, what we show is that when we compare two actual people with each other, not just focus on one, but two actual people with each other, that actually helps people calibrate their judgments, and they no longer need to rely on the reference person in their minds.
You write about this in the book, but you give an example when it comes to resumes. What can you do when it comes to looking at a stack of resumes that removes the bias that we have?
So certainly, again, blinding ourselves to the demographic characteristics of the people, their names in particular, would be a great first step. But in addition, one of the biggest maybe fats in our talent management is that we believe that by interviewing people, we would be able to predict their future performance. It turns out that unstructured interviews are a particularly bad predictor of future performance. And in fact, companies that still use unstructured interviews should do away with them tomorrow and replace them by work sample tests. These are tests which mimic the future jobs that we expect of a person, or maybe both, use a structured interview rather than an unstructured one where we ask the same questions, say the same 5 or 7 questions of all our candidates in the very same order, and we rate people's answers to each of the questions right after they've given the answers. We do that in order not to be biased towards the first answer that they have given. So let's assume the first answer was brilliant. It'll be hard for us to objectively assess their answers to following questions unless we rate them right away.
When it comes to the idea of looking at the answers to the question in structured versus unstructured, the questions that we ask one interviewee versus the other, we may not even be conscious of what we're asking and how different those questions are, meaning that in our mind, we are asking the same 7 questions, but in reality, we're not.
It's a very hard job. Yes, I don't want to hide that fact. It is a very hard job not to be distracted by also the kinds of answers that we get. I mean, somebody might start talking about a hobby that I share with the person. So I'm naturally inclined to want to talk about the hobby and celebrate the fact that we have so much in common. And I think that is really the trick of a experienced and interviewer with lots of expertise, that we try to force ourselves to stick to the questions and not be distracted by irrelevant information. There indeed is a lot of research suggesting that this other information is just noise. And the problem is that our minds are not well equipped to filter out the helpful information from the unhelpful information.
Give us an example of how changing the way we decorate the halls can help us remove some of the biases that we have.
Yeah, it sounds a bit like the holidays, doesn't it? yes, so role models really do matter, and it is real role models seeing counter-stereotypical people, seeing, for example, male teachers teach English or female teachers teach STEM subjects does matter. But more importantly to your question, and also something that truly is low-hanging fruit and that organizations can, in fact, change tomorrow, we're also influenced by the portraits on our walls. And in fact, let me share a story from my own organization, the Harvard Kennedy School here, which is not research, but might illustrate how deep this bias runs. So about 10 years ago, a colleague of mine, Jenny Mansbridge, realized that of all the portraits on our walls, exactly 0 were of female leaders. This is in stark contrast to our student population, which consists of 50% women, pretty much 50% women. And so they didn't have any role models to look up to on our walls. So we have, you know, to our credit, we have been changing this in the last 10 years, but it, in many ways, is shocking how long it took for us to realize. But that's, of course, not research, but there's real research where people have run experiments and had either male stereotypical images on the walls or female stereotypical images on the walls and measured how well boys and girls performed in tests, or also how the speeches were that students gave and could show that if, for example, a female student saw an image of Hillary Clinton instead of Bill Clinton or of Angela Merkel instead of a male role model, their speeches were objectively better and rated by observers as more powerful.
But there has to be an impetus, right? And I guess my question is, how is that not bias? So in the example that you just gave at your place of work, the pictures were up, and then at some point somebody says, okay, well, let's change that. But how do we get to that point where people realize that there is indeed a problem and the conscious work goes of, we have to design something that will change the situation that we have?
That's exactly what unconscious bias trainings are for. I agree with you that any change does require awareness of the problem. And so I think in order to understand the problem, we need to do two things. First of all, I would argue we need to measure. We need to measure what's going on. You know, is it a pipeline problem that we have in our organization that there's just not enough of X for us to hire from? Is it a promotion problem that we have, for example, gender promotion gap? Is it equally pronounced in all of our offices? So one study, for example, looked at a large law firm which has offices in 25 different countries. In theory, they have the same company culture, but in practice, they found that the gender gaps in promotions to partner, this was a law firm, varied by country and, in fact, had something to do with the prevalent gender norms in those countries. So measurement is the first step. The second step, then, is to say, well, you know, why is that happening? And unconscious bias tests are a very easy way for people to realize that this is about all of us and that we all tend to be the kinds of things that we don't want to be, including sexists. And then thirdly, it might require some, you know, well-meaning people such as my colleague Jenny Mansbridge, who walk around with a somewhat more open mind and detect these kinds of issues. But of course, we don't want random chance. I mean, in my example, this literally was just luck. We don't want this to leave this to random chance. That's why I go back to, you know, suggestion number one, measure. Do, you know, walk through your hallways, walk through your conference rooms consciously, and look at who is on your walls and think about changing that. MIT, for example, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, realized in the 90s that they also had to measure and literally took a measuring rod and went into people's offices and measured office space and lab space and resources and staff and found that they had a gender bias, which is now called a support bias, gender support bias, where women weren't given the same kind of resources to succeed as their male counterparts. So measurement, I do think, is the beginning of it all.
And as you write in the book, men are affected by gender bias as well.
Absolutely. So it really is the counter-stereotypical individuals which are affected. That's why I, in my book, try to focus both on male nurses or male kindergarten teachers, as well as female engineers and female CEOs or female professors, for that matter. It is the minority that is affected by our biases because we don't see them in those kinds of positions. And in the book, I share my personal story as well, where I took our older son to the daycare center for the first time. And one of the first teachers I saw was, in fact, a man. And I was shocked and thought, how could I ever entrust my child? And I share the story because this bias really is shared by all of us and in fact, one's own gender plays very little role in how biased we are. It has much more to do with who we see in those roles. So yes, men are absolutely also affected. And in fact, one of the reasons, the OECD argues, one of the reasons that our boys are falling behind in reading and writing in our schools is that they don't have male role models anymore in their English classes.
The book is fascinating. It is What Works, Gender Equality by Design. It is published by Harvard University Press. Iris Bonnet, I thank you so much for being with us this morning. A great pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you very much. Again, Iris Bonnet is a behavioral economist at Harvard University, where she is a professor, director of the Women in Public Policy Program, and co-chair of the Behavioral Insights Group at the Kennedy School of Government. The new book is What Works, Gender Equality by Design. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.